So welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Peter Anderson. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or inabilities. Heck, I even understand we have a committee to see if we can open our hearts to Tea Partiers and religious fundamentalists. Later in the service, we'll invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce themselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services, and they are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community like today, or by Reverend Sandy Ingham. Today, we'll be presenting a wonderful talk by Steve Paulson on the wonders of cultivating the wonder in the age of science. We'll have the chalice lighting now, and Ruth will light the chalice, and Steve will read the opening words.
The fairest thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion which stands at the cradle of true science. He who knows it not and can no longer wonder, no longer feel amazement, is as good as dead. We all had this priceless talent when we were young, but as time goes by, many of us lose it. The true scientist never loses the faculty of amazement. It is the essence of his being. Hans Selye.
I can think of no more incredible way to make a life for oneself but to be paid to talk to some of the most inquisitive and curious and exciting people in this century. Please put your hands together to welcome the 20-year executive producer of To the Best of Our Knowledge, Steve Paulson.
Thank you. It is a great pleasure to be here. And we have some technology here, which I hope will work. I want to start by reading a couple of quotes, which actually harkens to the earlier quote that I read. The first is from Albert Einstein. The most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious. It is the source of all true art and science. And the second quote is from Rachel Carson. A child's world is fresh and new and beautiful, full of wonder and excitement. It is our misfortune that for most of us, that clear-eyed vision, that true instinct for what is beautiful and awe-inspiring is dimmed and even lost before we reach adulthood. So I want to talk about wonder, what this experience is, why I think it's so important, and also a bit about the history of wonder, which is quite fascinating, and what wonder means in the age of science, because scientists are obsessed with wonder. If there's such a thing as holy water for atheists, and that includes many scientists, wonder is mixed into that H2O. Of course, wonder has always been a staple of religious experience. Just think of the great mosques and cathedrals, or the many rituals in a church service, like singing hymns or saying mass. Typically, they're designed to evoke a sense of wonder. So here's the question that intrigues me. If religion is not part of your life, where do you find wonder? My own fascination with wonder grew out of a book that I wrote on the debate over science and religion. The book, Adams and Eden, is a collection of interviews with a number of prominent scientists, philosophers, and religious thinkers. And there are a few questions I would always ask, and this was one of them. Are meaning and purpose strictly religious and philosophical questions, or are they also in the domain of science? I got lots of different answers. But when the conversation took a more personal turn, the scientists would often talk about how wonder and curiosity about the natural world is what led them into their scientific careers. I'm a radio guy, so I'm going to play a bunch of short excerpts from interviews I've done with some well-known scientists, all reflecting on what wonder means to them. The first is with the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. You heard a bit of him in that mashup earlier. He's the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, and in this clip, he's talking about the very first time he went to a planetarium as a child, which happened to be the Hayden Planetarium. So here is the trick, is to see if this is booting up.
There's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room, and the light's dim. You don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. And I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck, star-struck, really, by it. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder.
Huh. How old were you when that happened?
I was 9.
That's astonishing. I mean, you now run the Hayden Planetarium.
Yeah.
What do you think happened during that experience when you were 9? Was it just how overwhelming it all was? How surprising?
Exactly. And I've later done some research on this as director of the planetarium. And what we found, in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark, it's got to be bigger than you are. You have to turn your head up and down, left and right, to see what's going on. And there are sounds and smells, and you're transported. What we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious. And it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity.
So how do you think we can inspire that sense of wonder in kids, specifically through science?
They already have the wonder. My worry is, how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here. Huh. It's adults run everything. The kids are already curious about the natural world, and left to themselves, they will explore it, period. So the real task of the adult is to get out of their way.
So what happens in school then? Because so many kids are turned off of science in elementary school.
Holding aside that they might have just simply had a bad teacher, the good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disrupting. And that is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is, I have this energy, it's gurgling within me, I've got to express it somehow. I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery.
The neurologist Oliver Sacks is famous for his remarkable and truly wondrous stories of people with brain disorders, from Parkinson's disease to autism. His books include Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. What makes him so fun to read is his endless curiosity and also his natural empathy for his patients. They are never just case histories. You always get the sense that he cares deeply about these people. So I asked Oliver Sacks how wonder figures into his life.
Wonder has been very central in my life. I think wonder combines many feelings: curiosity, awe, and a sense of beauty, a sense of depth. And for me, the natural world and the world of human creations give me all the wonder I want. And I don't feel any impulse to wonder about a supernatural realm. But I think that without wonder and its complement of doubt, nothing new would ever be done.
Hmm. Do you think wonder is ultimately an intellectual experience, or is it something more at the emotional level?
I think it's always both.
And it sounds like you're saying that that experience can come to you in different ways, maybe through the experience of nature, through music.
Yes, and as a sort of shortcut through drugs, but that was a long time ago, and through falling in love, and through just being alive and whatever, sometimes seeing animals at play. I happened to see a clip on television last night, a friendship between different species, between a bird and a tortoise, and between a goat and a horse, and these filled me with wonder. And I think wonder may also have an element of the comic in it. These things were wonderful and funny.
By the way, that reference to drugs is a fascinating footnote. It turns out Oliver Sacks had a very colorful history with some powerful hallucinogens back in the 60s. Today, we tend to think about wonder as almost childlike, seeing the world with fresh eyes, but it hasn't always been this way. In fact, wonder has its own history. Plato said wonder is the beginning of philosophy, and in the medieval world, wonders were often considered monstrous. They were the oddities of nature: two-headed snakes, twins conjoined at birth, newborn babies who seemed to be neither boy nor girl, but something in between. Trying to explain these oddities and marvels became an obsession for the founders of the scientific revolution. The historian of science Lorraine Daston calls 17th century Europe the Great Age of Wonder, when Europe's greatest philosophers and scientists were scrambling to formulate a modern science. To do this, they felt they had to be able to explain the oddball cases in nature. If you couldn't explain the anomalies, the wonders, you wouldn't understand the underlying laws of nature. Lorraine Daston told me that even the founding fathers of science, I mean, some of the greatest names in the history of Europe, they were saying things that sound crazy to us today.
In Descartes' case, he thought he could explain what was an old medieval marvel, namely the allegation that a victim of a murder would bleed again, the corpse would bleed again in the presence of the murderer or the murder weapon. Descartes thought he could actually explain this with his mechanical philosophy. Leibniz sent in to the journal of the Paris Academy Royal of Sciences a report of a dog that could talk. It could bark out six words in French, including chocolat. So Galileo, when he went to Rome, made it a point to bring with him Bologna stone. Bologna stone is a phosphorescent mineral that glows in the dark to show off to the Jesuits. He described the four moons of Jupiter, which he discovered, as meraviglia, as marvels. Everybody was trafficking in marvels in the 17th century.
This fascination with wonders also caught the public's fancy, especially the Wunderkammern, the so-called cabinets of curiosity, which would probably be better translated as chambers of wonder. These were extravagant collections of all kinds of strange and exotic objects, everything from paper money from China, that no one in Europe at that time had ever seen paper money, to pointed toe slippers from Turkey, to crocodiles, armadillos, and birds of paradise. You might say these were the very first museums. Now, it's worth pointing out a few things about this history. At one time, there was no clear distinction between man-made and natural marvels. They were all part of the same brew of wonders. Wonder could also be scary. As Lorraine Daston says, there's a kind of Bermuda Triangle of terror, horror, and wonder, which have deep subterranean connections with each other. Frankenstein's monster is the quintessential example. Today, we've largely domesticated wonder, but it used to be something that would grab you and shake you. There's also a difference between wonder and awe. Awe is an experience so overwhelming that it's both frightening and thrilling. Think about hanging over the edge of the Grand Canyon. That would probably give you some sense of awe. Historically, the experience of awe was thought to have a connection to the supernatural, as if you'd brushed up against the awesomeness of God. Now, all this might seem like ancient history, but I'm going to play another clip, which is, I think, an illustration of awe in our own time. This is from the noted cell biologist Ursula Goodenough, describing something that happened when she was about 20 years old. During college, she was shaken by a kind of existential panic after taking a physics class. Here's how Goodenough describes the experience which hit her during a camping trip when she looked up at the stars.
I suddenly realized that I was no longer thinking of this cute little round planet with a sky over it, that the whole thing was huge and immense and that the sun was going to go out. And I got very, very upset and disoriented and fearful, terrified, actually. And that stayed with me for a long time until I was able to work through it.
So how did you work through it?
Well, I realized that the real problem was that I was trying to find some point in it. And what I could do instead was to just realize that why there is anything at all, why the universe is here, why I'm here, is a mystery. And mysteries are not terrifying. They're just things that you don't understand. Once I did that, I could just take the whole story and take quarks and electrons and galaxies and everything and just say, okay, this is the way it is. Don't know why, but wow, it's pretty amazing. And lucky me to be a part of it.
Hmm. So you're saying this kind of scientific understanding, I mean, the more that you mm-hmm. really get into the way life evolved, where the Earth came from, all of that, that really evokes for you profound feelings of awe and wonder.
You bet. I can't think of anything that even comes close.
Ursula Goodenough went on to write a terrific book called The Sacred Depths of Nature. She doesn't believe in God, but she does call herself religious because she is intensely interested in ultimate questions. In fact, she calls herself a religious naturalist, which is a label that I'm willing to bet we will hear more about in the coming years. Richard Dawkins would not call himself a religious naturalist. He despises everything about religion. Dawkins, of course, is the world's most famous atheist as well as a prominent evolutionary theorist. He's also a wonder junkie, though his take is a little different from that of Ursula Goodenough or Neil deGrasse Tyson. I just interviewed Dawkins actually just a few days ago. Here is a short excerpt from that interview.
Reality is very beautiful, and the fact that we can understand it is beautiful. And there is poetry in understanding where we come from, why we exist. There's poetry in understanding the stars, the vast distances between them, the laws that govern the structure of the universe. There's poetry in the vast expanse of geological time.
Well, I'm wondering, when you use the word poetry in this sense, is that another word for wonder?
Yes, I mean, I guess that's the aspect of it that's particularly relevant to science, yes.
Your book is called An Appetite for Wonder. Where do you go looking for wonder?
The real world. And it's hard work understanding the real world properly. That's, I mean, science is hard. But, I mean, you also get it by just imbibing it, by just looking up at the Milky Way, by looking at fossils, by looking at the Grand Canyon. All these things engender wonder. The trick is to immunize yourself against what I call the anesthetic of familiarity. We're so familiar with the world in which we live, and we've become inured to its wonder. And that's a great shame. It should be possible to wake up each morning as though it was the first morning you'd ever lived and say, what an extraordinary thing it is that here I am, surrounded by my cousins, the cousin trees, cousin lions, cousin dogs, all of them produced by the same extraordinary, remarkable process of evolution by natural selection. Get rid of the anesthetic of familiarity and imbibe the extraordinary fact of your own existence.
Well, I guess if to experience wonder, you need to see the world in an unfamiliar way. I'm wondering if you still find wonder. I mean, you're thoroughly well-versed in understanding the science of all the things around us. How do you cultivate wonder?
Not that well-versed. I mean, there's still plenty to learn. There's still plenty for all of us to learn. But even the bits that you already do know, it's possible to imagine yourself into an imagined world which you're experiencing for the first time. So imagine that you never heard of a forest before. Imagine you've just been plonked down, arrived from Mars, and you're walking through a forest. Try to capture that feeling.
I've talked with various scientists about what they mean by wonder, and it's kind of fascinating, the different kinds of responses I get. There are some people who say it's really more of an intellectual understanding of, you know, how things work, how the world is put together, whether through evolution or cosmology or whatever. There are other scientists who say that wonder is really an emotional experience. Where do you come down on that?
Well, I do think it's both, but I think that I would be reluctant to let the emotion take over. I think anybody who lets the wonder be all that they care about and not really care for understanding, or even worse, say that understanding spoils the wonder, which has been suggested, that's even more pernicious. I think that understanding is part of it.
So there's a deep question we're asking here. Can science itself produce the experience of wonder? And the answer, I think, depends on how you define science. I'm going to play a clip from the cosmologist Brian Swim, who talks about the universe not so much as a place, but as a story. And it's a narrative that has not ended because the universe keeps changing. New creatures, including human beings, evolve. Swim believes there's meaning in this story.
Here's how I think of wonder. We wonder at the stars. Humans have wondered at them. There's a kind of majesty and mystery there. And then by pursuing that wonder, say we've been on the planet for 150,000 years. It took us 150,000 years, but by pursuing that wonder, we came to realize that we are composed of the elements constructed by the stars. That's an amazing discovery. Then you take it a step further. You're looking up at the night sky and you realize we are those stars reflecting on themselves. Incredible. And how did we come to this discovery? Because of wonder. Then there's an idea worth thinking about. Maybe it's possible that, among other things, the universe wants to reflect upon itself. It doesn't just want to complexify. It doesn't just want to bring forth life. It also wants to marvel over itself. And so it brought forth humans who, by pursuing wonder, could become that space where the universe becomes amazed at its own nature.
So, Brian, you are a cosmologist. This seems to be a little different than what most cosmologists do, this kind of thinking about the universe. How did you get interested in, I suppose we could say, these more spiritual aspects of the scientific story?
Well, I had this amazing experience. When I was a young professor, they asked me to address the incoming students, not alone. So I was on a panel. The woman who went before me was an English professor, and she was talking about her work in mythology, and she was describing a few of these Greek myths. Then it was my turn. I said, I'm just amazed and studying the way in which we can now detect the light from the beginning of time. But what I noticed in the room was, I don't know, there's like a stillness or something took place that I really noticed among the young students. And it just dawned on me in that moment, this is years ago, that what I was saying to them had a kind of power that Greek myths used to have. It just hit me that what I was saying was introducing these young minds to the ultimate nature of things. And later in my classes, they would say, well, what about the meaning of life? And that
which is not the kind of thing that scientists are supposed to talk about.
Exactly. And that was made very clear to me by my colleagues. My life has been reflecting on this question. Okay, we've got this amazing science. What's the meaning?
That's cosmologist Brian Swim. So how do you cultivate wonder? I think there are various ways. Be open to new experiences. Seek out novelty, but don't take everyday experiences for granted. Revel in the glory and vastness of nature. Allow music and art to transport you. Let the experience wash over you. And don't get caught up in your own ego. Let go of your sense of self if you can. Try having an encounter with another species. My last clip is from the primatologist Birute Galdikas. She was one of three pioneering women chosen by Louis Leakey to study the great apes, the others being Jane Goodall with chimpanzees and Diane Fossey with mountain gorillas. Galdikas went to an extremely remote part of Borneo to do the first long-term field study of orangutans. It was grueling work, but intensely rewarding. Galdikas says that some of her encounters with wild orangutans have at times felt otherworldly, especially when she stared into their eyes and they looked back at her.
It's almost like finding God. It's a powerful moment of transcendence. It's suddenly you realize that you're not alone in the universe. And those moments were very, very powerful. And of course, they came from the fact that there was total, absolutely total isolation. And they came out of the fact that there was total acceptance on the part of the orangutans, and possibly on my part as well, of the situation. And those moments had the intensity of a religious experience. The setting does reflect, you know, the kind of setting that we have in Gothic cathedrals or in mosques. There's sort of these beams of light, you know, that shoot from the sky, and there's a sort of a hush and a quiet. And I think that what churches try to do is they try to duplicate, you know, the ancient forest from which we came. And so, like, when you go into the forest, it's like going into a church, but not into a church created by humans, into the original church, into the original, you know, Garden of Eden, which was our home, which is where we became human. These kinds of experiences help explain why people frequently become almost addicted to helping certain species, or become addicted to nature. It's because they find something there that they can find no place else.
There's this odd room. It's round.
Now, I can't let you go without mentioning another great naturalist, Rachel Carson. She is best known for her classic book, Silent Spring, which warned us about the dangers of DDT and other toxic chemicals, but she was also fascinated by wonder. In fact, she wrote a great magazine essay back in the 50s, which was later turned into a short book called The Sense of Wonder. She writes about walking along the seashore and into the woods with her two-year-old grandnephew. They would touch moss in a forest after a rainfall or watch a bird migration in the moonlight. So unlike the 17th century fascination with the oddities of nature, Rachel Carson was looking for wonder in the ordinary, in everyday experiences. And she wrote this remarkable passage, which I want to quote. "If I had the influence with the good fairy who is supposed to preside over the christening of all children, I should ask that her gift to each child in the world be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout life as an unfailing antidote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength." And I can't imagine saying it any better. Thank you.
Anyone have any questions?
Oh, yeah, the question was, what has instilled the sense of wonder in me? And it's a, my answer is complicated on that. So part of it is, so I've been kind of mining this world of science and religion, the relationship between them for, oh, probably 7 or 8 years now. And I seem to be obsessed, sort of trying to figure out sort of where these connect, where they don't connect. And I've sort of looked at a lot of different sort of disciplines that are kind of vehicles for this, whether it's neuroscience or cosmology or the study of sacred text. So that's kind of the more intellectual piece of it. I've had a few experiences that have been out in nature that have just, I would call them ecstatic experiences. And so just to talk about one of them, this was years ago, I was hiking in the Waimea Canyon on Kauai in Hawaii, and there's something just kind of hit me, just kinda sort of came over me, and I just was, I don't know if overwhelming is the right word, but I mean, I just definitely felt transported. I mean, I was sort of in this different frame of mind to the point where I was tingling in a way. And sort of the overwhelming feeling that I had was everything was right. Everything was right in the world at that point. And it didn't matter if I was there. It really didn't matter sort of where people were in all of this, but it was just, there was something rightness. There was something right about that whole experience. And so I had one other experience, similar experience like that on Sanibel Island in Florida a few years ago. And so there's that piece of it as well. And those are a couple of ways that I have responded to this. Other questions, comments? And I would love to hear, instead of just me being up here being the expert on wonder, which I'm not, if any of you want to share your experiences and, you know, if any of the bits of tape that I played resonated with you in any way, if you want to disagree with any of that, I would love to hear that. And there are, well, just to talk about atheists for a moment, and there's a whole different camp of scientists who are religious, and we should not neglect those, but there are, this is sort of a very broad generalization, but there are the atheists who really don't like religion, Richard Dawkins being one example, Sam Harris being another, I mean, both scientists. And then there's another group of atheists who I would call spiritual atheists, and who don't really much like the Dawkins-Harris approach to some of these kinds of things, and they don't like the animosity towards religion. They are not religious themselves, but they say you don't have to bash religious people there. And there's sort of a question, one of the tensions that I think comes out in some of the clips that I played is how much mystery are you willing to let into your life? How much are you willing to live with uncertainty, with not knowing? And is that okay with you? And I mean, this is really interesting because I've interviewed a lot of scientists, and sort of my little hobby horse for the last couple of years has been the science of consciousness. I did a 6-hour series on consciousness. And I've interviewed a lot of people about that. And actually, I think that's sort of where the rubber hits the road on the science and religion question, not evolution and creationism. The really interesting question is the mind, the brain-mind connection. And the interesting question there is, will science ever be able to explain the mind? I mean, right now it can't. And so then I asked the neuroscientists, I asked Richie Davidson on campus here, and you know, he would sort of say, oh, you know, I never want to say that science can never explain everything, but, you know, he has an interesting take on this. And so there are a lot of, there are scientists who are very reluctant to say, oh, it's beyond science. It's sort of like no scientists want, I shouldn't say no scientists, a lot of scientists don't want to say it's beyond science. And then other people are saying, who knows? In fact, I was part of an event a couple of nights ago at the Science Festival in town here with Roald Hoffman, who's a Nobel Prize winning chemist, and he has dealt with some of these issues. And I asked him sort of this question about wonder and mystery, and he said, you know, the funny thing is, I don't think science necessarily will be able to explain a lot of this stuff, and I've come to that conclusion the older I've gotten. Yeah, one of the most eminent chemists in the world. So anyway, I could go on about that, but there are different perspectives on this, including among scientists and including among atheist scientists. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let me bring this back to science, but, and this is a really interesting question about the place of humans in the evolution story. I mean, one of the most interesting questions, and this is something that Brian Swim, the cosmologist, alluded to, is was the evolution of humans more or less inevitable? And I mean, this is a huge question which has profound religious implications. I mean, I think one of the reasons why a lot of religious people object to the evolution story is it's not just the do you read the Bible literally, it's if humans were an accident, an evolutionary accident, what is, you know, where does that leave us? I mean, that's kind of tough to swallow, frankly. And so, but there's an interesting scientific response to that. And so, for instance, there's a Cambridge University evolutionary paleontologist, actually, named Simon Conway Morris, whose life work has really been trying to make the case that if you give evolution long enough, if it starts somewhere, you know, 3.5 billion years ago, let's say, and, you know, you let it play out long enough, you will get intelligent creatures. There is sort of this drive towards greater complexity, ultimately towards consciousness. Hugely controversial idea. Interestingly, Conway Morris is evangelical Christian. Richard Dawkins also makes this argument, incidentally. And this is the basic premise of the SETI project, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence on Other Planets, is that that evolution would work more or less along the lines of the way it works on Earth here. And, you know, why are they looking for intelligent creatures elsewhere? They're looking for the signs that evolution would work in kind of similar ways and that eventually you would have intelligence elsewhere. And so one of the questions here, which is, I don't know how much of this is a scientific question, how much of it's a philosophical question, is there something inherent in the story of the universe that leads to consciousness? Just put that out there. I don't know the answer. It's much harder to create a robot that can walk across the room without tripping than to be a chess genius. Yeah, it's a really interesting question. The role of artificial intelligence is absolutely part of this question of consciousness. So there's a branch of computer people. The most famous one would be Ray Kurzweil, who believes that we are approaching what he calls the singularity. That somewhere down the road, I think he might say it's in 2048, he has a year for it, that humans and machines will merge. And these are transhumanists, is the word that is usually used to describe them. I think most scientists probably think this is unlikely. And I mean, the premise of this is that our brains work like computers and that you can essentially download the brain into a computer, I mean, all of that. And I think there are various reasons why people object to that. One is the idea that it's just strictly information, that it's sort of like a computer, and a lot of people would say that consciousness intelligence has to be embodied. I mean, it's the way our bodies respond to the world as well. Let me sort of also mention another response to this. I did an interview not that long ago with a neuroscientist named Christoph Koch, who is one of the most was one of the pioneers in the search for what is called the neural correlates of consciousness. So he and Francis Crick were the guys who really sort of put this on the map. This was probably in the maybe early 1980s or so. Crick, of course, of Crick and Watson fame, broke the double helix code. And so Crick he has sort of an interesting story. Diehard atheist, by the way. He sort of did this amazing work in molecular biology, and then he took on a whole new field of inquiry, which was consciousness. And he sort of thought neuroscience has to understand consciousness. You have to understand the connection between brain and mind, otherwise it's just never going to add up. And he recruited, or he came across this young scientist from Germany, Christoph Koch, and so they did a lot of this pioneering work. Francis Crick died, you know, 20 years ago or so, but Koch is still very much with us. In fact, he is now, he was for years at Caltech, and he's now leading the science program at something called the Allen Institute for Brain Science or something like that in Seattle, which is trying to map the wiring of the brain. And Koch, he has the argument that consciousness is ultimately about complexity. If you put, and he says, I mean, what people say about the human brain is that it is the most complex object ever discovered in the universe. There are something like, I think there are close to 100 billion neurons in the average human brain. There are trillions of synapses. I mean, it is phenomenally complex. And I mean, the idea of trying to create a map, this is what they're doing. You know, President Obama has committed billions of dollars in research for this, trying to map the wiring of the brain. I mean, if you thought that mapping the human genome was hard, I mean, this is infinitely harder. And Koch's argument is that it's just about, you need to have enough complexity. And if you have enough complexity there, then ultimately you could get consciousness. So in other words, you don't need, it doesn't matter what the neurons are made of, it's how they're wired together. And so his argument, sort of the radical thing that he sort of said in this interview that I did with him, was that it's possible that the internet could be conscious or could become conscious. And I said, how would you know that? And he said, well, it's sort of like if things kind of like, it starts to do some weird stuff, or, you know, it's just like, and he said, like, what, it could be, you know, have a sense of humor? Yeah, it's sort of, you know, he says, you know, it could, you know, manifest its way, and yet it could feel happy or sad, potentially, the internet. I don't know, anyway, I'm just saying that's, you know, a very prominent neuroscientist, so they love to think about this stuff. I don't actually encounter much of it, but I think it's because of the rarefied public radio circles that I move in. So, but I mean, I don't. I actually like talking to people who have a sort of religious orientation. I tend not to talk to the diehard creationists, and I'm not sure if there's much to say there. I mean, I think one of the questions about the evolution creationism question is whether, is this really a disagreement on intellectual grounds, or is this more part of the culture wars? And it's probably more part of the culture wars. It's probably more a manifestation of people who belong to certain churches who are told, you know, you can't believe this evolution stuff because it's going to violate what the Bible says. And I mean, there's a whole fascinating, interesting history on creationism as well, because this kind of biblical reading is actually fairly new. And I mean, yes, there was the Scopes trial, but for a long time, most religious people did not read the Bible literally. That's sort of a more recent, that's a strand of religion, and actually the foremost book of the history of creationism was written by a historian of science here at the UW around Numbers. And it's a fascinating story, and it's kind of a story that is actually the modern interpretation of creationism is more about the history of geology, which is interesting. It's sort of, you know, layering, but there's sort of this strand of creationism that's come. So what to do about that? I don't know. I mean, I think one thing that does help is it's probably counterproductive for scientists to bash religion, because then the creationists will just get more defensive. They'll say, I mean, the Dawkins argument has been, you can't accept religion if you accept the story of evolution. It's probably wrong. I mean, he is wrong about that. Anyway, so that's it's.
The closing words. The scientific theory I like best is that the rings of Saturn are composed entirely of lost airline luggage. Thank you for coming. Don't forget, we have a talk back at 11:30 right over here. Please extend your hand of friendship to those around you, and then join us for coffee in the foyer for conversation. Thank you again.